Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Asia House. Thank you for coming today to this talk, which should be great. I want to say thank you to ALCA and the Bagley Foundation for their continued support of our program, and also to the Arts Council. So talking today is Isabella Tree, who began traveling around Asia as a child with her parents, I think first to Kashmir and Ladakh, and then you've been regularly to Nepal since the 1980s. And you've written many books, non-fiction books, and your writing has also appeared in Gramsa, National Geographic magazine, The Sunday Times, The Observer, amongst other leading publications. So Isabella's going to talk today about her book, The Living Goddess, which is a wonderful read, which is a pastiche of myth and legend. You know, you really get a sense of exactly the kind of the background of all the stories that surround the living goddesses. It also combines this, you know, you get really up close and personal with people who are living goddesses, finding out what's happened to them, as well as introducing the living goddess. And, you know, it's a kind of a tribute in a way to your time in Nepal, and you really get a sense for that. So it's a fantastic read, and she's going to do a fantastic talk today. So let's wish her a warm welcome.
Thank you very much. It's absolutely wonderful to be here. I've never been to Asia House before. It's a fantastic building. I'm thrilled to be here. Anyway, thank you for coming. I'm just sort of setting the context here. You'll all probably be familiar where Nepal is, but it's just at this moment in time, I think we're all familiar with the Himalayas and what's been going on. So I will talk more about that at the end of my presentation and give you a sort of update about the living goddesses, the Kumaris, and how they are post-earthquake and their response to the earthquake. So just a short thing at the end, just to put you in the picture. But meanwhile, just to reassure you that everybody I'm talking about in this presentation is alive and well and have survived. I first went to Nepal in 1983, and I was travelling in my gap year with three friends. One of them is now my husband, from school, and we ended up in Freak Street, as you do when you're a teenager, and we had no idea what we were doing. We just landed up in the old centre of Kathmandu, beautiful place, and we thought we would just catch the tail end of the hippie era and just hang out. What we didn't realise, I'll just give you a picture, just an idea of what our gap year was like. That's my husband and me. This is right opposite the old royal palace, opposite a big tower called Basantapur Tower, which is now half the size it was. Anyway, what we didn't realise when we fortuitously landed up in Freak Street was that just next door to us, diametrically across the square where we landed up, was one of the most extraordinary buildings in the Kathmandu Valley. And this is the Kumari Chen, Kumari Gar, or the Kumari House, where one of Nepal's most extraordinary personalities, characters, people, lives, the living goddess. Many of you, I imagine, have even been here and actually gone into her courtyard. But I remember the day when I slipped between those rather imposing stone lions at the entrance, and you duck your head through a little doorway. That's intentional because it makes you already humble. You duck your head through the doorway, and you end up in this little medieval courtyard. And as a foreigner, it's taboo for you to enter her building. Only Hindus and Newar Buddhists can go inside, where they can go up to the top floor and worship her on a simple throne. But if you're lucky as a foreigner, you can stand in the courtyard and she will appear for you at that top window in the middle, always at the middle window. So there we are, lots of tourists waiting for her to appear. And so we did this. We stood in the courtyard for what seemed like an interminable amount of time. And suddenly, without any warning whatsoever, the living goddess appeared. It's taboo to take photographs of her at her window when she's actually in residence in her building. You can only take photographs of her when she comes out of her building, which is about 13 times a year on festival occasions. So this is a photograph taken of her on a festival. So she has her third eye, which is only worn for festivals, and she's got this red crown of flowers on her head. But even on a normal day, when she appears at the window, it's a very, very striking, imposing sort of effect. She stares at you with this kind of very prepossessing sort of adult kind of demeanour. And you're standing in the courtyard, and it's almost as if the roles are reversed. You know, suddenly she is the one in control, in this position of power, and you're just sort of standing there wondering, you know, what is going on? Any tour guide will tell you that she mustn't smile. If she smiles at you, it's an invitation to heaven and you will die.
Okay.
So this is why she has this really extraordinary, inscrutable, serious face on all the time. But her eyes are always outlined very exaggeratedly to her temples. This is to emphasise the sort of communication, this divine darshan between the seer and the seen, the god and the devotee. She's dressed in red, and this is very significant because it's the colour of energy, of creative energy, Rajas colour, which is usually preserved for married women, for women who are, you know, married, going to give birth. It's the symbol of blood, of creativity, fertility. So it's very interesting that this little child is dressed in this colour. It signifies the fact that she embodies creative energy, this omnipotent female energy, Shakti. And she is believed by Nepalis to embody the goddess Talaju, who is like the goddess Durga, an omnipotent deity. So for me as a teenager, this was a complete revelation. Here was a place where the almighty God was female. You know, for me, you know, Christian background, this was absolutely extraordinary. So I was immediately very intrigued by the whole thing. So from that moment on, it was as if her presence, being right next door to where we were living, sleeping at night. At night, we could see her, a little figure in red, running past the windows of the palace. She shadowed our whole existence there. And you can see her name. It's used on all, you know, on the banks, cinemas, beauty products, a bit like sort of Lakshmi, perhaps, in India. Her name, her very name, is believed to bring prosperity and blessings. So, you know, use it and your product will soar. There was very little I could find out about her at the time when I was a teenager. She is a Newa. So she comes from the indigenous inhabitants of the Kathmandu Valley. They are people who speak their own language, a Tibeto-Burman language called Newari. They speak Nepali too. So to most visitors, first-time visitors particularly, you don't know or notice the distinction between Nepalis and Newaris. Because Newa speak Nepali, it's easy to gloss over that and believe that everyone is, you know, part of the same homogenous community. But in fact, it's a very distinct one, and most Nepalis who aren't of the Newa community don't speak Newari. So they are a people who live traditionally in the old towns, in the Durbar squares of the Kathmandu Valley, and who consider themselves to be the custodians of Kathmandu Valley culture. So she's a Buddhist, which again, often people assume that she's Hindu because she's worshipped so openly, especially on big processions by Hindus. But she is a Buddhist, and she's worshipped by Hindus and Buddhists, which again is an unusual thing. She's from the Shakya caste of goldsmiths, a caste of Newas, who are very high caste. They're from a priestly caste, they're goldsmiths by tradition, and they trace their descent from Shakyamuni Buddha, from the Buddha himself. She's chosen at the age of about 2 or 3, and then she's taken away from her parents and installed in this palace, this house on Kathmandu Durbar Square, and she's looked after by a family of hereditary caretakers who are also of the same caste as her. And because this is quite a small caste, it's likely that they're actually related. And so the lady on the left is Durga Shakya, who is one of the caretakers. She's actually caring her. And so I think they were cousins, actually. But they're often very closely related. One of the criteria for choosing the goddess is absolutely extraordinary. I love it. She has to have the 32 lakshana, the 32 physical characteristics of a bodhisattva, an enlightened being. And these are just absolutely wonderful. She has to have the voice of a duck, legs like a banyan tree, neck like a lion. I mean, there are obviously things that she hasn't got, but these are intuited by tantric priests who go into a deep meditation, and they somehow recognise these traits in her. She can't leave the building, except on festival occasions, as I said, and that's about 13 times a year. And it's very important that her feet don't touch the ground, because that will pollute her. So when she goes out, she's carried in a palanquin on the shoulders of these Japu farmers, these bearers. This is a fantastic silver palanquin, which was so heavy, it was donated by a family, it was so heavy that actually they could only lift it for a couple of blocks. So usually she's on a sort of slightly lighter wooden one. Or she's carried in this huge golden temple chariot, which is dragged around the streets of Kathmandu, around the old city walls, to kind of reinforce the sort of protective energy within Kathmandu. Another crucial thing is that she can't bleed. So while she is Kumari, enormous care is taken that she doesn't even scratch herself. So much as a little graze would dismiss her, the goddess would leave her. So inevitably, when she reaches puberty, she has her first period. And that is when a changeover happens, and another little girl is found, and literally the spirit, the Shakti of the goddess, is poured, you know, ritually poured from one to the other. So as a teenager, I was sort of completely befuddled by all this. I wondered what it meant to be a child in this house. What did it feel like? Was she happy? Was she bored? Was she lonely? What went on inside the house? There were lots of rumours at the time, some of them still go on in the media, about ex-Kumaris, saying that they can't get married. Men are very fearful of ex-Kumaris because of their residual power, that snakes come out of their vaginas when a man tries to go to bed with them. Or even on the opposite scale, they are trafficked as prostitutes to Mumbai and Bangkok, like so many thousands of other Nepali girls. But it was impossible for me to find out really anything about these rumours, whether they were true or false, or if there was any substance to them at all, because the living goddess is bound up with this very secretive world of Tantra. And this is a sort of esoteric strand of Buddhism and Hinduism that still exists and is very, very powerful in Nepal today. And by tradition, you can only understand these inner esoteric teachings if they're passed down to you personally by a guru. And this would be a lifetime's dedication to this. And, as an outsider, it's almost impossible to gain any access to this sort of inner world at all. But then, much later, about 14 years later, I had a breakthrough. I went back to Kathmandu, and I was staying with a great friend who had married the commander of the Gurkhas out there. Her Nepali teacher, I was talking to him about the Kumari, and you know, I went to have a look and have darshan at the house again, and there was another little Kumari at the window, but the same sort of extraordinary prepossessing presence. And so I was asking him about this, and my friend's Nepali teacher said, well, why don't we just go and see an ex-Kumari and ask her about it? And I suddenly thought, well, can we do that? And he said, of course we can. There's 9 or 10 ex-living goddesses living out their normal lives in Kathmandu, and my auntie lives next door to one of them. So I thought, fantastic. So we went along, and we met. This is how I met Rashmila Shakya. She's here sitting between her parents. She's absolutely delightful. This was in 1997, and she was 15 or 16. So she'd been dismissed about 3 years before. She was lovely, smiley, welcoming, warm, but could hardly speak. She spoke in a whisper. She didn't know how to articulate. She was very, very nervous in front of strangers. So this interview with her took at least a couple of hours, and it was very difficult to tease out the sort of information. She was clearly still shell-shocked from having been a living goddess. And this was 2 or 3 years later. Just for example, as a child, she would have been barefoot all her life inside the Kumari Chen, and running around on floors like this, smooth, wooden, beautiful wooden floors. And now she's in the outside world, and she is having to deal with pavements, you know, potholes, crumbling buildings, traffic, just using her body space, understanding how to, you know, walk through crowds was completely difficult for her. She would lose her way. She didn't know, you know, couldn't find her way through Kathmandu. So she was still going out in the streets with her sisters, and they said they were sort of laughing about it. They did tease her in a kind of warm way, but I mean, they're very close. But they said, you know, that walking about in the streets with her was like taking a horse out for a walk, because she would literally pick her feet up over every obstacle and clomp about because she was wearing shoes. She'd never worn shoes before. But despite all this, you know, these difficulties and these hurdles that she was trying to overcome in her assimilation back into the outside world, what was most striking to me about meeting her was her absolute conviction that what she had done was for the good, not just of herself and her family, because it's believed to bring many blessings, but for the good of all Nepalis, in fact, for the good of all sentient beings. And one of the reasons for this is that every year the king would come and bow to her feet. And this is a hugely symbolic act, because there you have the most powerful man in the country, a Hindu, having to bow, touch the most sacred part of his body, his forehead, to the feet of not just a child, but a female child, a Newar, an ethnic minority. And so this, on a very public platform, is a sort of surrender of ego. It's an acknowledgement that in her, within this little child, resides the will of the people of Nepal. And without her blessing, without her tikka on his forehead, he cannot rule the country. So this is a huge thing. And if it doesn't, if he doesn't get this blessing, as has happened many times in the past, he simply cannot rule the country. And there's lots of cases. I think King Tribhuvan, I think, didn't receive the blessing. This was in the 1950s, and within 2 months he was dead. So it's still very, very strongly believed that this is an important ritual. And this is a tradition that goes back to the Mala kings in the 14th century. The Kathmandu Valley, very briefly, was governed for about 400 years by the Mala kings, who were three dynasties of kings ruling out of three different cities. So Kathmandu, Patan, and Bhaktapur, these beautiful, beautiful cities that have been sadly very shaken by the earthquakes. But they each had their own Kumari, their own living goddess. And they believed that worshipping the child, this little girl, was the most powerful way to connect themselves with the almighty, fierce mother goddess. It was a way of empowering themselves, a bit like sort of Superman receiving the kind of rays of energy from the sun. This was a way that they could actually charge energy into their kingdom to make it invincible. And they used Kumaris also in a way as psychic spies, because these children who had the connection with the goddess could see all things through their third eye, past, present, and future. And they could see where the enemy, according to the kings, they could see where the enemy was, they knew what time to attack, and they could charge the king with such power that he could just simply breathe into his army, and they would become invincible. So this was a belief that went on for centuries, and the valley did indeed become renowned as being invincible, impregnable. It had this sort of mythical this idea about it that no one could conquer the Kathmandu Valley because it was protected by a goddess. And here we have Prithvi Narayan Shah, the unifier of Nepal, and the man who did manage to conquer the Kathmandu Valley finally in 1768. He's the unifier of Nepal. That's why he's got his finger up in the air. He's one country, one nation. And he had wanted to conquer the Kathmandu Valley for decades. He had besieged it, he'd been taking forts all around the valley rim, and still it would not fall. The Malla kingdoms remained impregnable. And he realised eventually that the only way he could conquer the valley in his mind was to fight fire with fire and to become a Kumari devotee himself. So he started worshipping these very powerful mother goddesses on the valley rim and generate this Shakti with which he could defeat the Malla kings. And one of the most famous stories in Nepal is of how he finally broke into the city of Kathmandu. He broke through the city walls. He was told by his royal astrologer the exact time to attack. And this happened to be when the living goddess was on her temple chariot being pulled around the streets of Kathmandu. So all the inhabitants of Kathmandu were propitiously drunk. They couldn't resist. And the king, Jayaprakasha Malla, the last Malla king of Kathmandu, was put to rout, fled the city. And the Kumari, on her chariot, finished her circumambulation of the city, came back to Kathmandu Durbar Square, got her out onto her throne, and waited to present the king with her blessing. But of course, the Malla king had fled, so the Shah king just knelt down in his place and received the tikka. And that was it. With no more ado, he became the king of Kathmandu. I talked about some of the times in the past when King Tribhuvan hadn't received the blessing. But there's a even more recent event, obviously, when things went very, very awry, because the Kumari is supposed to protect the king. There's a sort of symbiotic relationship. If the king behaves as he should and worships her, then she will protect him and she will give him the energy to rule. So what happened here? 2001. This is the royal family massacre. You may remember it. 2001, when Crown Prince Dipendra here shot his entire family, including the king and the queen, his younger brother, his sister, 11 members of his family in all. You can see them here in the cremation ghats at Pashupati. So to Westerners, this horrific event was explained by the fact that Dipendra was a sort of drug-crazed playboy, obsessed with guns, jilted. He was longing to marry the girl he loved, and his parents had refused to allow that. So he was furious, and this boiling anger had erupted in this ghastly slaughter of his family. But to Nepalis, in particular Newars, and particularly those involved in the living goddess tradition, there was an even more sort of sinister, explanation for this. Because a few months before this happened, the reigning Kumari was affected by a skin rash that began to creep up her body and affect her face. So Kumaris always have to be very pure. Their skin has to be very pure and blemish-free. If something like this happens, it's almost like her having a rash or a cut. It's a dismissible kind of event. It's an indication that the goddess isn't happy inside her body anymore. So this would probably have been enough grounds for dismissal as it was. But then, according to the royal astrologer, the old royal astrologer I interviewed, she had her first period. It took everybody by surprise. She was 12 years old, and she had her first period. So the goddess had left her. But remember, this was 2001, and this was a very inauspicious year. It was not just the royal family massacre. It was the year of 9/11. There's a whole catalogue of sort of typhoons and earthquakes and disasters that happened in 2001. And there were very few auspicious days during that period in which a new Kumari could be installed on the throne. So in effect, what you had during the time of the royal family massacre was no protective living goddess on the throne. And that, to the Newa community, was completely significant. If there had been, the king would be protected, and there was no way that this kind of event would be able to happen. Nowadays, the president comes to kneel at her feet, and it's still regarded as a hugely significant event. People wait with kind of bated breath to see if he is going to be accepted by her. And again, it's a very important reminder to the king, to the man in power, even if he's not a king anymore, he's an elected president, that the will of the people resides somewhere other than himself. He has to acknowledge a greater power than himself, and this is hugely important. And it's more than that, really, because it kneeling at the feet of a child has a profound psychological effect on you. And I realised this when I did it myself, because some way into this very long 14-year period of research for my book, I realised that actually there's not just one central Kumari in Kathmandu, there's 10 of them. And they are scattered throughout the Kathmandu Valley. And because they are not so... So such a focus of the national attention, they're not on such a high political scale, the traditions around them, the rituals and taboos are more relaxed, and you can, as a foreigner, go and visit them. So that's me at the end. Actually, that's a slightly anomalous Kumari who's very old. She's now about 56. She's never bled, so she's still a Kumari. And that is apparently medically possible. She hasn't menstruated. But what I realised from discovering all these other Kumaris is that actually it's a much, much older tradition than we ever knew before. This tradition dates back way before the Shah kings, way before the Malla kings. It goes back to a time in the whole of South Asia when little girls and, to a lesser extent, little boys were worshipped as conduits for divinity. In the 10th century, I think, we have the first text, the Kalachakra, which was widely disseminated throughout the whole of South Asia, where it describes worshipping little children as instant connections with the divine. And in Nepal, this idea found a natural home because it was already a focus of mother goddess worship. It was boosted by shamanic practices of spiritual possession, but also it was far enough away from the empires of the great empires of China and India, where the patriarchal influences felt very difficult with this kind of practice going on. So it became almost like a refuge, a sanctuary for this sort of tradition. And it, as it died out elsewhere, pushed out of the way by the patriarchal religions, it has stayed very much entrenched in Nepal and is part of the whole structure of Nepal society to this day. So I was able, as I say, to meet them. And this is Chanira Vajracharya, who was then Kumari of Patan. And to me, I just went to meet her and I did what is expected of you, but I was really struck by the effect it has on you doing this. I'm not a particularly religious person, and I go to church as a Christian, I suppose, for weddings and probably more funerals these days. But when I do, I tend to do what I think most of the congregation do now. We don't get to our knees. We don't do that anymore. We sort of crouch in a sort of Rodin thinker kind of a way with an elbow on the front pew. And somehow we have lost that humility. At least this is how it felt to me, having not knelt on my, on the floor before anything or anybody since I was a child. And it really made me feel like I, had to surrender my position of control, my adult superiority, And it was very interesting that this sort of difference it makes to you. But Newars do this on a regular basis, and they don't do it just in front of Kumaris, these permanent Kumaris who sit on a throne. It's mirrored at every level of Newar society. So there are puberty rites, pre-puberty rites, which are all linked with this idea that little girls contain this Shakti, this powerful energy. And here we've got, this was a wonderful event in Kathmandu's Durbar Square when 365 little girls were dressed as Kumaris, and all of them were worshipped in a row, one by one. And here you see them all dressed up in their blingage, and, you know, I love the one arriving on the motorbike with the shades. And just worshipping. If you're, you know, there were queues of people, just people passing by in the street to worship them, because for this one day they are goddesses. And just kneeling down to our 365 little girls is sort of exhausting, but it also kind of fills you with this idea that it's not just them, it's every little girl in Nepal, it's every girl on the planet. It was a wonderful, wonderful sort of event. So I didn't want to sort of leave you with this impression of Rashmila being a sort of quiet as a mouse 16-year-old. This is her in her mid-30s. She is now an articulate, outspoken, wonderful, confident woman. She has an MA in information technology. She is a computer software programmer and doing incredibly well. And she's also delightful. But this was taken at a wonderful event in Kathmandu's Durbar Square in the Old Royal Palace to honour all the ex-Kumaris of Kathmandu. And so here you see them, for the oldest on the left, right down to Rashmila's towards the end, and there's one more beyond her. And I love this photograph because, to me, it encapsulates all the sort of stages of womanhood in one row. And in an instant, it makes you realise that these rumours that ex-Kumaris are thrown on the trash heap are absolutely untrue. Every single woman, except for the younger ones, Rashmila towards the end, are married. These older ones have grandchildren, great-grandchildren. They're feisty, amazing women. A couple of them are nurses, and one of them owns a pharmacy, a trade store, runs a pharmacy. They're just extraordinary people. At the end of the ceremony, Rashmila stood up and spoke. You know, this was a girl I'd met when she could hardly speak at all. Stood up on a podium in front of a crowd of three or 400 people, and explained what it had felt like for her to be a Kumari and how important it was for us to continue honouring the gods and particularly honouring the Kumari tradition. And one of the verses from the Uttara Tantra seems to sum it up. She said, "Look upon a woman as a goddess whose special energy she is and honour her in that state." So when I heard about the earthquake a couple of weekends ago, it was obviously terribly distressing, and I immediately tried to find out what had happened to all my friends and Kumaris and people I'd met over the years. Here's what was happening. I mean, you've all seen photographs, but it was absolutely terrifying. And actually, I was having lunch with somebody yesterday who had been trekking just north of Gorkha, where the epicenter was when the earthquake hit. She's Canadian, actually, but her descriptions were beyond terrifying, and she then just got back on Friday. So I have been Facebooking, and that's my new medium. I've yet to discover Twitter. I've got to get onto that. But yeah, everyone seems to be, you know, Facebooking, and that's and there's an amazing Facebook list where you can register yourself safe or presumed safe. If somebody knows that you're safe, they will say, "I've heard from them," or "I've heard that somebody, a neighbour, has seen them." So instantly you can see ticking boxes. Oh, thank God, they're okay. But it's also how they're communicating. And so I've been talking to Rashmila, who actually has been, you know, handling people, you know, taking, you know, rubble off out of buildings to get to people. She's been working the relief effort. And particularly Chanira, the little girl that I was kneeling in front of, She's now 19. She's the same age as my daughter, so I kind of think of her in parallel with my daughter, and they've known each other for ages. They've been Facebook friends for ages, and I'm only just getting used to it. But so I've been talking to Chanira and to the caretakers of the Kumari house, and I must just show you, actually, what's happened to the Kumari house. So here we are in Kathmandu Durbar Square. This is the old royal palace. The facade, this rather modern sort of 19th century, late 19th century facade, you know, it's pretty okay, but the back of it, a lot of it is destroyed. This huge tower has come down. Lots of courtyards have been destroyed. It's a terrible disaster. And this is a temple to Vishnu Narayan, and that is, you know, where we used to spend hours just whiling away the afternoon sitting. That's come down. Another temple here has come down. Here's the Kumari house. Not a single tile off its roof. Absolutely extraordinary. I've even seen this drone footage going over it, and you just can't see. On buildings on all sides, there's just rubble, and there is this Kumari house absolutely unscathed. The Kumari caretakers told me that when the earthquake happened, it was a Saturday, the day of worship, and the Kumaris, all the Kumaris would have been on their thrones, and the Kathmandu Kumari showed absolutely no sign of fear whatsoever, just sat there completely impassive. And eventually they lifted her off the throne and took her into the courtyard for safety, but she was completely unflustered. The story from the Patan Kumari was a similar one. She, when she was on the throne, her family panicked and they went into complete sort of overdrive, and she went into a trance. She's only 7 years old, the one in Patan. Went into a trance and she said, "Stay in the building, just stay in the building." And so they stayed in this 14th or 15th century building. You know, why would you? But they did. And buildings came down on either side the whole way down the street, and that building was fine. So the Newar community is obviously very, very impressed by this. And to them, to Kumari devotees, this is definitely a sign. But to the Kumaris themselves and the caretakers, some of whom have family members, friends who've lost houses, who've lost possessions, in amongst all this loss is an even deeper anxiety that the earthquake is the voice of the Mother Earth, that the earth cannot bear the burden of people's sins anymore, that we have been losing touch with the gods and not worshipping them in the right way. People have been losing this discipline of the niyams, and that particularly with regard to the earth itself, we've been polluting the earth, we've been ploughing the earth, which is like scraping your nails down your mother's face, and the water table is now polluted, and that is very important for Newars because you need pure water for rituals. So there's all this sense of people losing their compassion for each other and for the earth, and that this is one of the reasons the earth has spoken, that the earthquake was a wake-up call for humanity. Thank you. There's only two Kumaris, the one in Kathmandu and the one in Patan, who are confined to their own building. The one in Kathmandu is looked after by a caretaking family. The one in Patan stays with her own family. And so during the day, a private tutor comes in for 4 hours a day and gives them lessons. So the idea being that when they leave being Kumari, they go straight into their peer group at school. Chanira, the 19-year-old, actually passed her school leaving certificate while she was Kumari, with distinction. So they get a very good tuition nowadays while they're Kumari. So a large portion of the day is taken up with that. The Kathmandu Kumari, she can play with children, the caretaker's children, the younger children, if the others are at school. Her own siblings can come and play with her, but her parents can't interact with her in the same way, so they can't hold her or cuddle her or talk to her like they would have. The pattern can work like is different because she's with her parents. And certainly there is definitely a residual kind of sense of respect. Not all people know who they are. So if you're a Newa or a local or a member of their family or a cousin or a friend, you would still call them Dio Meju, Mother Goddess, quite possibly. And at school, quite often the teacher will say, Mother Goddess, do you have anything to say? But some of them, Chanira I know now is at college, and she doesn't want people to... It's a long story if someone meets you and, so you are a living goddess, and, So she doesn't let people know, and they find out eventually. But she is sort of anonymous, and she prefers it that way, actually, just because it's a huge explanation.
Emotionally, how do they make that switch? Are they... Because it's a big thing, they don't have a normal, what we consider a normal childhood. So how does their emotional development happen? They're not with their peers, they're not in the outside world, there's no interaction, no dialogue. And then you're suddenly in this big bad world.
It is a huge thing. It is a huge thing. And I think it seems to take, from talking to all these ex-Kumaris, about 2 or 3 years before they really feel... that they've literally found their feet again. But they have very loving, devout families. I mean, these are very devout Buddhists. And the Kathmandu Kumari is obviously the most difficult one because she has been taken away from her parents. Patan Kumari has been with her parents, and school children can come and see her. So she has much more interaction, even if she can't actually leave her building except on festivals. So it's really a problem for the Kathmandu Kumari more than any of the others. Because all the other ones you saw go to school like anybody else. They just dress up in red with a top knot. So for the Kathmandu Kumari, it is definitely very difficult. They maintain a very strong bond with the caretaking family. So the eldest caretaker has become like a surrogate mother. And it's very important to keep that bond, not to break that. So they can go back to the Kumari house as many times as they like when they're just leaving. And Rashmila used to go, and she used to flee there in tears, saying, I don't want to be living in the outside world, I want to be back. And I asked her, and so she'd go and stay there for a few days, and slowly she got adjusted, and she said, I came to understand that I was being reborn. This was a new life now. Very, very sad and poignant, but she's still very, very close to the Kumari family. And I asked her if she ever felt jealous of the new little girl sitting on her throne, and she said no, she never felt jealous, and she actually slept by her bed on the floor.
In terms of the succession, you describe how that process is affected, but obviously as a girl is moving towards puberty, there's an expectation that shortly her time as Kumari is going to come to an end. So, do you have a pool or collection of baby Kumaris?
Yeah, very good question. That's exactly what they do. So, obviously, the Kathmandu Kumari is much, much more important. If she's got the safety of the whole nation in her hands, you don't ever want a hiatus. You have a royal family massacre happening. So, the idea is that you actually look for the signs of puberty, and you dismiss her just before she reaches puberty. And they always have a Kumari in the wings, who's the right age, whose horoscope has been checked and has the right things. And then, if necessary, they can quickly switch one over. But anyway, they will try and preempt that dismissal moment. What happened in 2001 was it came upon them completely unexpectedly. Oh, sorry, lady behind you, first.
Is silence a really large part of their ritual? So when they actually make their appearances out in public, are they supposed to talk to people? Are they supposed to be silent?
No, absolutely supposed to be silent. And they're silent on the throne and when they go outside. I sort of you know, because I'd only ever seen living goddesses on a throne when they are completely silent. I thought, gosh, they spend their whole lives like this. You know, how weird is that? But actually, then Chanira hopped off her throne, went back and sort of did a sort of, you know, another little ritual. And then she came bouncing in, chattering away, that's a child I can recognise, you know. So it's only when they're on the throne that they become silent and then they stop smiling. And Rushmiller described it to me as they have these ornaments, which are very sort of empowering ornaments. And in particular, there's a Nagamala, a snake necklace. And she said as soon as that went round her neck, she felt different. She said she felt bigger and stronger and more powerful, and she didn't feel like smiling. She was the goddess. She felt totally transported. And that's the only thing I can assume. I mean, you see these little, you know, a little girl, you know, sometimes 3 or 4 years old, in a huge golden chariot, which takes maybe 4 hours on a procession around Kathmandu. She never gets up to go to the loo. She doesn't have a drink. She's not, you know... She just sits there impassively, and you think, my 3-year-old would never have done that. And it's this feeling that they have that they are, you know, different on the throne.
Did she? Did any of the ones you met who now come ex, did they ever feel like they still retained any of their divinity, or do they feel like they still have that kind of presence or power or anything like that?
I think. Let me see. I've never actually asked them, but I know that their families say that when they get married, they take extra care to make sure that the horoscope of the man is strong enough. So she's got to have a match that's strong enough to cope with this sort of this residual, you know, goddess. Yeah. You know.
Did the ones you interviewed feel like they've had a lost childhood? They, you know, haven't been able to play and do the normal things?
No, I mean, Rushmiller has written this wonderful book. I mean, if you get a chance to get it, I think you can get it online, called From Goddess to Mortal, describing what it was like as a child. And I think she mentions on occasion when she was a bit bored or lonely in the living goddess's house, looking out and wishing she could play with children and go outside. But most of her description is about all the busyness going on inside the house and her pets and her dolls and the children she was playing with. So when I've asked all the ex-living goddesses that I've met, because I think in a way it's the easiest way to describe it, is rather than asking them, do you feel you've had a missed childhood? Because quite often someone would say no, even if they meant yes, you know, my life is my life and that's it. So I asked them all, would you allow your daughter to be goddess? Would you want her to be living goddess if she could be? And every single one of them says absolutely, they would be honoured. And Rushmiller herself said that it's like by the age of 13, she had already had a whole lifetime of experience. And this carries her through her present life. It informs her daily life all the time. So no, she you know, never expressed any regret at all, and she expresses it very articulately in her book.
Has the lineage ever gone from one goddess to her lineage?
I don't know. Probably not, because you... Oh, yes, probably, but it would have jumped a generation.
Yes.
You know, because obviously she'd have to get out and marry. But I'm sure, yeah, I'm sure that would have happened in the past, yeah. I mean, the thing is that in Kathmandu, there's 18 different courtyards, Buddhist courtyards, that the girls can come from. So they can marry between those lineages of the courtyards. In Patan, there's only one lineage. So I asked Chanira, you know, if she'd be happy if her daughter would be Kumari. And she kind of giggled and said, well, we can't marry within our one lineage. But if she went to Kathmandu and married a man from a Kathmandu Buddhist Bahal, and then she and her friend Samita, who's also an ex-Kumari, got carried away with giggles at the thought that they, if they had daughters, yes, they would.
Were there no more questions? Have you got copies of your book here?
Yes, yes, I believe there are. I believe you are. Yes.
Well, I think we should, you know, really a big round of applause. That was absolutely fantastic.